Noam Chomsky, world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author, laureate professor in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Arizona and professor emeritus at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he taught for more than 50 years. Next week, we'll bring you more of Noam Chomsky. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get our newsletter daily, text the word Democracy Now! To 66866. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Federal agents again used tear gas and less lethal munitions on Portland protesters. The city of Portland demands that the feds unblock a busy bike lane. And in national news, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has called for the reopening of schools. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 24th, 2020. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Last night, thousands of protesters again showed up in downtown Portland to demonstrate against police violence and show their support for Black Lives Matter. And once again, they were driven from the streets in a cloud of tear gas and a hail of less lethal munitions fired by federal officers. The evening began with a rally in front of the Justice Center, organized by the local NAACP. As that event ended, the crowd cheered as the wall of moms and hundreds of others arrived to set up a human barricade across the front of the center. A range of Black leaders and private citizens then took turns reminding the crowd to remain focused on the Black Lives Matter movement and not to be distracted by the provocation of federal agents. The predominantly white crowd of several thousand listened attentively and joined in strongly to chants of Black Lives Matter and I'm Not Scared. As the night progressed, the crowd slowly moved from the Justice Center to the fence in front of the federal courthouse. By a little after midnight, a familiar pattern reemerged. Some protesters began shaking and throwing debris over the fence. Federal agents began firing less lethal munitions through holes in the plywood barriers on courthouse windows and soon emerged releasing tear gas into the crowd. Twice, agents reportedly climbed onto blocks in front of the building to fire down demonstrators. At about 1:30 a.m., large groups of officers came out of the courthouse. Using tear gas and munitions, they drove demonstrators through the park and pursued them as far as Southwest Fifth Avenue before retreating to the courthouse. Via loudspeakers, the Portland Police Bureau reportedly called the demonstration an unlawful assembly and threatened protesters with tear gas and possible arrest, but they were not a visible presence on the street. And again, it was impossible to tell which federal agencies were represented by the officers housed in the courthouse. The Portland Bureau of Transportation has demanded that the federal government remove a portion of the fence surrounding the Mark O. Hatfield Federal Courthouse. The fencing is blocking the bike lane that runs along Southwest Main Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. The Bureau spokesperson, Dylan Rivera, said, quote, "Without any warning, without any discussion, and certainly without a permit, the federal government has installed an illegal fence." The Bureau pointed out that it was one of the busiest bicycle routes in the country. The U.S. attorney stated that the fence was built to protect the building and de-escalate tensions, but that claim was met with widespread skepticism. Portland Commissioner Chloe Udaly serves as the head of the Transportation Bureau and said in a statement, quote, "This fence was constructed without permission or permits on public property, and it is both an abuse of public space and a threat to the traveling public." The Portland City Attorney has sent the federal government a cease and desist order, and the Bureau has pointed out that the simplest solution is to move the fence onto the sidewalk that is within federal jurisdiction. For more than 60 days, Portland protests have focused on the Black Lives Matter movement and police accountability, with many calling for major reforms or outright abolition of the existing Portland Police Bureau. KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Portland Independent Police Review Director Ross Caldwell about these and other questions.
Portland's primary police oversight system is overseen by the City Auditor's Independent Police Review Division, or IPR. IPR was founded in 2001 after a citizen-led initiative to overhaul the 20-year-old system then in place. Since then, it has been both touted as one of the nation's best police oversight agencies and been criticized by Portlanders for inaccessibility and a lack of transparency around its investigations. The current IPR director is Ross Caldwell, a former Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney and Program Director at the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. KBOO spoke with Caldwell last week about IPR's response to calls for abolition and reform, complaints related to police attacks on protesters, and several other topics. It was recorded on Tuesday, July 14th, shortly after federal agents arrived in Portland.
So since the death of George Floyd at the end of May, has IPR taken or pushed for any specific changes to its mandate or processes?
Yeah, we've actually had a lot of things in place that we were starting to work on even before that happened. And we identified a number of changes we wanted to make to our process to have better accountability and greater transparency. And we worked on, you know, we had a lot of conversations with our boss, the auditor, about that. And she's very supportive of that. They matched up well with things that she wanted to change. If they didn't, I don't think we ever would have been hired to take these jobs. But long story short, we had a whole bunch of changes we had that we were looking at, and I really thought that we'd be kind of chipping away at these for years. And some of them involve amending the union contract, some of them involve city code changes, and some of them involve changes to state statutes. And so that's kind of a lot. And that's kind of a lot in the old world before George Floyd was killed and all the protests started. You know, it feels like a dam has really broken. It's something that I kind of never really thought I would actually see happen, where there's this much energy and attention around this stuff. And so some of the changes that we had hoped to make in the next few years and to really chip away at suddenly seem you know, maybe within reach, or like they could have a ton of support. And so I think there's a really great opportunity here to move things forward. It's also a little challenging because so many people are interested in this and weighing in on this, which is fantastic, but it does create a somewhat chaotic environment where I think we need to make sure that we can kind of bring in everybody's voice on this and figure out what's going to work for everyone. Because the system that we have right now, which has been evolving for the last couple of decades into what it currently is, it clearly is not sufficient. And so I think we have a lot of opportunity here to make great improvements.
Are you able to say if IPR has received any like increase or noticeable change in the number of complaints based on police actions during crowd control situations?
Yeah, we've received a huge increase. We've received several thousand emails, voicemails. A lot of those, most of those are not things that we can actually investigate because they're more kind of defund the police or don't use tear gas. You know, they're kind of like more like big picture policy statements, I guess. And a lot of them, there's a lot of form letters out there where people can go to a website and they can, it's kind of like signing a petition or something like that. So we've received a ton of those, but we've also received a really large increase in complaints about specific interactions with Portland Police Bureau officers, which is what we need to be able to launch an investigation. We've got a much higher volume than we normally have of complaints from people about specific interactions with Portland Police Bureau, and then also about interactions with law enforcement officers that they're not sure if they're Portland Police Bureau or if they're, you know, some other law enforcement agency, whether it's county or local or the feds. And so we've got a little over, I think, 50 investigations currently open that are related to the protests. And that might not sound like a ton, but that is 50 individual incidents that are being investigated. And then we've got a bunch more where we are trying to track down, you know, we're able to open investigations kind of on our own volition. So if we see a video on social media or online somewhere or on the news that is something that happened in the protest that we think is problematic, we can open up on our own. So we've got more of those where we're trying to identify the people, you know, and one thing we always have to figure out is this a Portland cop? Because if it's not a Portland cop, we don't have any jurisdiction. We're City of Portland employees, and our office is basically we're a creature of city code. So we don't get to, you know, that horrible video that I think everybody's seen from over the weekend where the federal law enforcement agent shoots the guy holding the jukebox over his head and fractures his skull with a rubber bullet or foam tip bullet. I'm not sure what kind of munition it was, but yeah. That's not something we can do anything about. It's outside of our purview. But yeah, long story short, I guess it's not short at this point, but we have a lot more investigations going than we normally do related to the protests.
That was Independent Police Review Director Ross Caldwell. The full interview can be found on the evening news page at kboo.fm. I'm Sam Bowman.
Yesterday, Oregon registered 329 new cases of the coronavirus, down from last Saturday's high of 389. Three deaths were reported, maintaining a 7-day average of 4 COVID-19-related deaths per day. Experts agree that the number of new cases are undercounted due to testing limitations. And yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority projected that the state will see 1,600 new cases per day by mid-August if the current rate of transmission continues. Rural counties are seeing a surge, with Umatilla County continuing as the state's leading hotspot, averaging 82 new cases per day. Malheur County is averaging 35, while Jefferson County is seeing 26 new cases. Of the three counties that make up the greater Portland area, Multnomah County is highest with 9.5 cases per day. But despite the disturbing outlook, yesterday, the Freedom Foundation filed a motion asking the Court of Appeals to block Governor Brown's statewide mask requirement. The governor issued the order that masks be worn in indoor public spaces on July 13th, saying, quote, "We need to do absolutely everything we can to reduce transmission in ways that do not require us to close down businesses again." But apparently, that logic did not sit well with the conservative nonprofit Freedom Foundation that has a long history of battling public employee unions. The organization claims Brown's ruling was made without following procedures defined in Oregon law and they violate Oregonians' state and federal constitutional rights. Jason Dudash, the organization's Oregon director, said that, quote, governors in left-leaning states all over the country are making up the rules as they go and ignoring the procedural rules their state laws set up. Neither the governor nor her staff have commented on the motion. Renters across the country are bracing for a wave of eviction filings as federal protections come to an end today. KBOO's Sam Bowman has more.
The federal moratorium on evictions ends today, in the midst of a nationwide upsurge in coronavirus cases. The timing could not be worse for renters whose income has been affected by closures and other measures to slow the spread of the virus. The CARES Act eviction ban applies to any landlord receiving federal funds or with a federally backed mortgage, about a third of all rental units in the nation. Other renters may be protected by local and state measures, but these protections vary widely, from nothing at all to Los Angeles allowing renters to defer payments for up to a year. According to a report by Law 360, 39 states are allowing eviction filings to proceed as of the end of last week. Predictably, in places where local moratoriums have already lapsed, eviction filings have increased dramatically. In Milwaukee, landlords sued to evict tenants 61 times in May. After the local eviction ban was lifted, that number soared to 1,500 in June. 2,300 eviction cases were filed in June in Harris County, Texas, where Houston is, and where more than half the population lives in rental housing. Across the country, states and localities are racing to come up with ways to mitigate the damage and prevent mass homelessness, many relying on funding from the very same CARES Act whose eviction ban and $600 unemployment bump both expire today. In Portland, on Wednesday, for example, the City Council approved a $114 million relief package using CARES Act funds, with tens of millions going toward rent assistance funds and household expense assistance. The measure was criticized by many, including the lone vote against, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, who believes that rather than give blocks of money to the usual set of social service agencies to manage, payments should be made more directly to households and communities in desperate need. Quote, in my view, many of the allocations do not do that, unquote. At the same July 15th council meeting, Commissioner Chloe Udaly suggested that the city pay for the legal defense of tenants evicted once Oregon's statewide moratorium ends on September 30th. According to the Oregonian, Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kafuri supported the measure's $19 million allocation for more social distancing shelters and converted motels to prevent the spread of the virus among the houseless community. Kafuri characterized the spending as a first step. Quote, there is no way that we are going to stop here. I'm Sam Bowman.
With dry conditions throughout the area and a heat wave on the way, Portland Fire and Rescue has issued an outdoor burn ban in all areas of Multnomah County. The ban goes into effect immediately and will remain in place until further notice. The ban includes campfires, fire pits, yard debris, agricultural burning, and permits for open burning. Outdoor barbecues are still allowed, but Fire Defense Board Chief Scott Lewis has asked residents to exercise extra caution. Temperatures on Sunday and Monday are expected to reach 100 degrees and remain in the 90s through Wednesday. The Weather Bureau has issued a heat advisory from 8 a.m. Sunday through 9 p.m. on Monday. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. Then at 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. And at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we'll see a partly cloudy evening with an overnight low in the mid-50s. On Saturday, expect a sunny and warm day with a high temperature of 82. On Sunday, we'll see a high of 100 degrees. On this date in 1974, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that President Nixon's claims of executive privilege were invalid, and he was required to surrender the Watergate tapes. The quote of the day is from Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, who said, quote, "It would seem that the Watergate story from beginning to end could be used as a primer on the American political system." earlier today, the day after Donald Trump decided to cancel the Republican National Convention due to coronavirus concerns, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a call for schools to reopen. The new guidelines came out 2 weeks after President Trump criticized their initial recommendations as, quote, very tough and expensive. The original draft of the guidelines had classified the full reopening of schools as highest risk and went on to say that many schools would find it prohibitively expensive or impossible to open safely. In the most recent version, the CDC emphasized the importance of reopening America's schools in the fall and repeatedly stated that children are at low risk of being infected or transmitting the coronavirus. Many experts questioned this position, citing a shortage of data. Others have suggested that children under 10 may be at low risk, but middle and high school students are at much higher risk. Large outbreaks in O'Fallon, Missouri, Middletown, New Jersey, and Chappaqua, New York, have already been linked to high school events. In addition, a South Korean study has found that children between the ages of 10 and 19 can spread the virus at least as well as adults. Despite the CDC guidance, many school districts have already decided that they will start the fall semester with remote learning for the safety of both the students and staff. The Senate failed to come to agreement with the White House on a stimulus plan, Trump canceled his nomination acceptance speech in Jacksonville, Florida, and the Biden campaign released a video of a conversation between the former VP and Barack Obama, drawing contrasts with Trump on healthcare and policing. With more on these stories, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Congress could play a role, certainly, in ensuring that people can have a safe, fair, non-discriminatory right to vote.
But they haven't yet, says voting rights expert Gilda Daniels, law professor at the University of Baltimore. Senate Republicans failed to come to agreement with the White House on the next coronavirus stimulus package yesterday. It's still unclear whether it will include election support. The House Democrats' bill proposed $3.6 billion.
States need money to actually increase vote by mail. States need money to increase early voting. States need money to adhere to the CDC guidelines for conducting an in-person election safely. Right? By having hand sanitizer and having PPEs, those kinds of things.
Yesterday, President Trump canceled the Jacksonville portion of next month's Republican National Convention, saying the timing isn't right for a big rally because of COVID concerns.
I care deeply about the people of Florida and everywhere else, frankly, in this country and even in the world, who would be coming into the state, and I don't want to do anything to upset it.
But former Vice President Joe Biden had harsh words for the president's approach to health care in a new campaign video with former President Barack Obama.
This guy's in court in the middle of a pandemic trying to take away the protection for 100 million people who have pre-existing conditions. I don't think he has any sense of empathy.
Obama and Biden criticized Trump's approach to police reform, among other things, and defended theirs. Here's Obama.
During my administration, our response was not to ignore those problems. Our response was we had the 21st century policing task force that we put together that drew police chiefs, academics, young members of Black Lives Matters.
Earlier this month, when asked why Black Americans are killed by police, Trump said, quote, so are white people, unquote. But Black Americans are killed at a much higher rate. The Departments of Justice and Homeland Security Inspectors General are investigating the conduct of federal agents President Trump sent to Portland to quell protests. The president is sending more to additional cities with Democratic mayors to, in his words, reduce violent crime. A misleading Trump campaign ad showing protesters attacking an officer turned out to be taken in Ukraine 6 years ago. Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas said he learned about officers in his city from Twitter. Chicago's also on the list. Here's Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth.
He wants to claim the title of the law and order president, but you know what? If he wants to do that, then he needs to call Mitch McConnell and tell him pass sensible gun control legislation.
Duckworth says what Chicago actually needs are investments in social services and proven violence intervention programs.
I'm pleased that the administration appears to have agreed not to do what they did in Portland and Chicago, but you know, law enforcement agents are meant to protect and serve our communities. That's not what the Trump administration is doing in Portland.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
With millions of Americans still unemployed and eviction and foreclosure moratoriums set to expire, Senate Republicans and the Trump administration have not been able to agree on a new coronavirus stimulus package. And this is only step one in a process that will need to be negotiated with Senate Democrats, reconciled with the House Heroes Act, and signed by the president. Although they hope to unveil their package this week, their inability to address payroll tax cut, money for coronavirus testing, aid to states and cities, unemployment insurance benefits, and a host of other issues means that they will not have a proposal before next week at the earliest. The democratically controlled House passed their $3 trillion coronavirus stimulus package, the Heroes Bill, in May. And although everyone knew that bill would be dead on arrival in the Senate, it was at least considered a starting point. Estimates were that Republicans would put together a package worth closer to $1 trillion. But with their fates linked to an increasingly unpopular president, a divided group of Senate Republicans has been unable to find common ground even amongst themselves. And despite the fact that 30 million Americans are facing economic disaster, some senators don't feel the urgency to act. In his opposition to state and municipal bailouts, Florida Republican Senator Rick Scott said, quote, "Every day they wait is a good day for the country." Many have stated their opposition to an extension of the extra $600 in unemployment benefits that were implemented with the CARES Act. Even if they do come up with some level of additional unemployment support, the discontinuation of the current program means that it will be weeks before most states can begin including any new payments into their systems. The Task Force on Protecting Native American Children held a White House briefing this week. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Presidential Task Force on Protecting Native American Children briefed the White House Thursday. First Lady Melania Trump was joined by task force members to hear about what steps are being taken by the Indian Health Service to protect Native children. The task force was created in March 2019 following the child sex abuse conviction of former Indian Health Service doctor Stanley Weber. Weber's serving prison terms for sexually abusing boys on the Blackfeet and Pine Ridge reservations. The task force examined systemic problems which failed to prevent the doctor's actions. Co-chair of the task force, U.S. Attorney Trent Shores, says their investigation included traveling to Oklahoma, New Mexico, Montana, and South Dakota to meet with tribal leaders and healthcare workers. Shores says a lack of specialists to serve tribal communities played a major role in Weber's case.
We sadly learned that there were times when, even though a doctor's background appeared problematic, that a licensing committee would still accept them into their hospital and into their community because of the overwhelming need. And we saw that in part with somebody like Dr. Weber, who, although folks had suspicions and had allegations that he was a pedophile, people were afraid to come forward because he was one of the few pediatricians that they had.
Among recommendations, the need for the Indian Health Service to have uniformed policies on reporting child sex abuse and training for employees. Shores says the task force recommendations go beyond politics and are needed to protect children and to uphold treaty and trust responsibilities. Vietnam veteran and acting chair of the National Indian Health Board, William Smith, urged U.S. lawmakers this week to improve health care for Native veterans. He testified virtually before the House Subcommittee for Indigenous Peoples of the United States, saying Native veterans have served in every military conflict and enlist at high rates, yet face challenges in accessing benefits through the Veterans Affairs Department.
When receiving care through the VA outside of tribal sharing agreements compared to other populations, our Native veterans reported longer wait times, more challenging in scheduling, less satisfaction with how healthcare problems are explained, less respect from VA employees, and the feeling that VA employees don't accept us for who we are. No veteran should have the feeling this way. Shamefully, our Native veterans experience this more than any other VA population.
Smith says the federal government has dual obligations to Native veterans through treaties and benefits for their military service. He advocated for the passage of the Purchase Referred Care for Native Veterans Act, which would reimburse the Indian Health Service and tribes for care from outside providers. The Havasupai tribe in Arizona welcomed the approval of the National Defense Authorization Act, which includes provisions for protecting the Grand Canyon. The legislation includes making permanent a 20-year ban on uranium mining near the national park and tribal land. This week, the House and Senate approved their versions of the spending bill. Tributes have poured in across Indian country for Native journalist Harlan Macosato. Well known for his years-long work as former host of the radio talk show Native America Calling, a sister program of National Native News. A statement from his family said he passed away this week at his home in Albuquerque, surrounded by family and friends. His sister told the Santa Fe New Mexican, a publication he wrote columns for, that he died of complications from alcoholism, adding his struggles with addiction did not dim his gift for storytelling. Our thoughts go out to his family. Macosato was 54 years old. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 24th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Ray Bodwell, and Yasmin Kobanoglu. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening.